This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On today's show, we're talking with two reporters in Iraq who are not embedded with the U.S. military. Jonathan Landay is the national security correspondent for Knight Ridder newspapers. He's in northern Iraq, where the Kurds have been living under their own rule for about a decade, protected against Saddam Hussein by the no-fly zone. Things have been relatively quiet where Landay is, but that may be about to change. Last night, more than 1,000 U.S. paratroopers dropped into northern Iraq, securing an airfield and opening a northern front. We called Landay earlier today on his satellite phone. Tell us where you are and why you're there.
Okay, at the moment, I'm about 20 miles west of the city of Sulaymaniyah, which is in the Kurd rebel-held enclave in northern Iraq. I am on the side of the road speaking to you over my satellite phone, and I'm on my way to a small town called Cham Chamal, which is about 400 to 500 yards from the Iraqi front lines that are defending the city of Kirkuk. I'm here because Kirkuk is got to be one of the primary or most important objectives of any U.S. military campaign here in Iraq, especially of any military campaign that is opened from the north, from the rebel Kurdish-held area in northern Iraq. Kirkuk is a place that not only sits atop one of the largest deposits of oil in Iraq and perhaps in the entire Middle East, but it is also a place where there are ethnic disputes, and kind of it epitomizes some of the more difficult issues that are going to have to be grappled with by the United States and its coalition partners when this military campaign is over and there is a U.S. military occupation of Iraq.
So you've been spending your nights right near where the Iraqi front lines are, the front lines defending Kirkuk. Do you get to actually see the Iraqi troops?
Absolutely. We can see them very plainly through, actually, if you get up close enough, right up to the beginning of a 400-yard no-man's land, you can see them quite distinctly on top of their bunkers. You can also see them quite distinctly through binoculars, and we actually have witnessed U.S. airstrikes on their bunkers along the that are defending the road that leads from the city of Sulaymaniyah. It's a four-lane highway that goes through their lines and onto the city of Kirkuk.
What kind of battle are you expecting there?
It's really hard to say at the moment because the United States had wanted to open a northern front using 60-odd thousand American troops backed by tanks and all of the implements of modern warfare, but they ran into a problem, and that problem was the fact that the Turks, the Turkish government, was not agreeable, not amenable to allowing the use of their military bases as launching pads, as staging pads, for the opening of a U.S. military front in the north of Iraq, and therefore that hasn't happened. Now we do have American special forces present here in northern Iraq. There was an airdrop on Wednesday night, actually early Thursday morning, by a little under 1,000 paratroopers of the 173rd Paratroop Regiment that flew in from Italy and took control of an airfield to the west of me in another part of the Kurdish enclave controlled by one of the two Kurdish parties that control the enclave. But beyond that, there are no major U.S. military formations here in the north, and no way do they have anywhere near the kind of troops they need to be able to open an offensive on the Iraqi army formations that are defending Kirkuk and then to the west, the city of Mosul, which is also sitting atop of major oil deposits.
So in the meantime, you know, you're kind of waiting to see what's going to happen in Kirkuk. What are you doing in the meantime? Where are you looking for your stories?
Well, there's been quite a lot to report until very recently. We have a situation brewing up on the northeastern border of the Kurdish enclave and Iran, where there is a pocket of of Kurdish Islamic fundamentalists who are allegedly allied with Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network. Reportedly, there are dozens of al-Qaeda members who have escaped the U.S. military operations in Afghanistan and are being given refuge by the Kurdish Islamic group, which is called Ansar al-Islam, or the Partisans of Islam. That is why there are quite a few numbers of U.S. special forces here. There is a planned offensive to go in there and take control of this enclave and crush Ansar and any al-Qaeda members who are there. We think we are coming fairly close to this offensive because an associated Islamic group that held territory on the right flank of al-Ansar vacated its positions today. Hundreds of them and their families have been leaving that area, and we believe that there is an offensive in the offing. So there's been that to report. There are very compelling internally displaced persons stories, people, Kurds who went through the deprivations against them by the Saddam regime, the chemical attacks during the what was known as the Anfal campaign in 1988, when thousands of Kurds were killed in chemical weapons attacks by Saddam. Thousands were massacred. There are more than 180,000 odd who are unaccounted for. And then again in 1991, you had another huge refugee outpouring from here when former President Bush instigated and then abandoned a Kurdish uprising following Saddam's defeat in the 1991 Gulf War. Those experiences left really, really deep scars in the collective Kurdish psyche, so there's those kind of stories to report as well.
Jonathan, how have the Kurds been taking the news that Turkey is now saying it won't send additional troops into northern Iraq? That's something that the Kurds had been worried about. They don't want Turkish troops to cross the line. Is there a lot of relief now that the Turks are saying they won't send additional troops?
Absolutely. There's a great deal of relief among Kurdish officials. Earlier in the day, I spoke with a very senior official of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, which is the Kurdish rebel party that controls the part of northern Iraq that I'm in. I expressed enormous relief that they will not have to deal with a Turkish military incursion, and yet there still is some lingering apprehension that the Turks may still come in. It's a very complicated situation here, and this is, again, why I'm here, to particularly focused on the Kirkuk situation. The Turks are fearful, or say they are fearful, that under the cover of this war, the Kurds here in northern Iraq could revive a drive for an independent Kurdish state, even though senior Kurdish leaders have repeatedly renounced any intention to seek an independent state. Nevertheless, the Turks say they are concerned by this, and in particular are concerned that if the Kurds take control of Kirkuk, they will then have control of enormous financial resources in the form of the oil that is beneath the territory of around the city, and that they could use those resources to fund and rejuvenate a drive for independence. And the Turks themselves have actually threatened to invade if the Kurds try to take control of Kirkuk. The problem here is that there are tens of thousands of Kurds and other minorities, Turkmen, Assyrian Christians, who over the years have been ethnically cleansed in successive waves of ethnic cleansing by the Saddam regime, forced out of their homes around Kirkuk and other areas nearby Kirkuk that sit atop oil deposits, and Arabs have been put in their properties, Arabs from other parts of Iraq. This Arabization program basically aimed at ensuring that oil-rich areas of northern Iraq are not under the control of minorities, that there is an Arab majority in these areas that are traditionally home to minorities.
What reaction have you been getting to this war from the Kurds you've been talking to? I mean, the Kurds really hate Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein has ethnically cleansed them from certain towns. He gassed the Kurds. So, you know, if anyone has a right to hate the Kurd, to hate Saddam Hussein, it's certainly the Kurds. But how are they seeing the war and how it's been going?
It's very multi-leveled, actually. It depends on who you talk to. Senior Kurdish officials are extremely happy with what's going on. Their number one priority is to see Saddam out of power. But when you talk to other people, for instance, ordinary people, I spent about an hour sitting in a barber shop yesterday just chatting with the guy who owns the place and a couple of his friends. They're kind of frustrated because they follow what's going on in the south on satellite television, particularly Al Jazeera, the Arabic language television, and they're getting frustrated that there hasn't been a similar offensive by the United States opened from the north. On the other hand, if you talk to other people, I talked to a group of guys who were sort of standing around a fire yesterday in one of the bazaars trying to keep warm. They were quite happy with what's going on. Again, their mood reflected one of relief that somebody is trying to get rid of the man who has oppressed them for so many years.
Is there a sense of confidence that America and England will win this war and that Saddam Hussein is history? Or do you get the feeling that the Kurds are still unsure about which way it's going to go?
No, I haven't found that on the part of anybody I've talked to. They seems to be this confidence, perhaps bred by American propaganda, U.S. administration propaganda, that the United States military is the best and that it's unbeatable and that they're going to continue fighting this war until Saddam is gone. And that's the message that people are believing here. And yet there are some apprehensions if you talk to people. One of the guys I was talking to yesterday was expressing concern for ordinary civilians in other parts of Iraq. They're worried about the humanitarian aid concern, the humanitarian aid situation. They're worried about civilians in places like Nasiriyah, in places like Najaf, in places like Basra, not having food and not having water. And they would like to see this war over with, they say, because they don't want to see ordinary Iraqis. They say not just the Kurds, but all Iraqis have been suffering under Saddam.
You've been spending a lot of time in Cham Shamal, which you write has become...
Yes, I have.
You say it's become a town of men, that almost all the women and children are gone. Where have they fled to and why have they fled?
Most of them have fled to relatives who live in villages in the inner parts of the Kurdish enclave or fled towards the Iranian border because there is this lingering concern, this lingering terror, actually, that Saddam may use chemical weapons against this part of Iraq, particularly if it's used as a springboard for the launching of a northern front by U.S. forces. And therefore, a lot of people most men have sent their families out of the city and then returned to take care of their own properties. Plus the fact that Cham Shamal sits, the end of Cham Shamal sits literally 500 yards from the end, from the Iraqi front lines defending Kirkuk. Now, it's curious. We've just received a telephone call from somebody down in Cham Shamal who say that the Kurdish rebels have taken control of a major bunker complex on those Iraqi front lines about 500 yards from Cham Shamal. These are bunkers that were bombed yesterday by the United States and several times before then. So it seems that it was quite a smart idea for a lot of people to get their families out because it looks like that there could be a lot of fighting in Cham Shamal in the coming hours and days.
You've also spent a lot of time in Shoreish, which is about 25 miles away from Kirkuk. And this is a town that's basically like a resettlement program. These are people who were ethnically cleansed from where?
Most of these people were ethnically cleansed from Kirkuk. There are about 45,000 people who are living in pretty bad conditions. They're rudimentary homes. They've been there for a while, so people have settled in. It's open sewers, muddy roads, no regular plumbing, although they do have standpipes for people, you know, sort of community faucets where people can fill up their water containers, and there are water deliveries. But essentially, this is a place of internally displaced people who have been there beginning in 1988, and then another wave of them was pushed out in 1991 after the collapse of the Kurdish uprising. And so it's a kind of an interesting place that survived to a great extent on smuggling. A lot of the men who live there still have family on the other side of the Iraqi lines, and really the only thing they could do to supplement their incomes, and their incomes, I should say, are only the food they get through the UN Oil for Food program, is to smuggle. And as soon as the Iraqis started building up their forces on these front lines, most of these guys had to stop smuggling because it became too dangerous. And therefore, the poverty in Shoreditch has increased quite substantially. And again, like Chomp Chamal, which is very close to Shoreditch, most of the men have taken their families out of this place because it's even closer to the Iraqi front lines than Chomp Chamal. And in fact, there are sometimes the Iraqi troops on the front line fire into the buildings at the end of Shoreditch. So it's a kind of dangerous place also.
It must be strange to be in these towns of all men.
It was kind of amusing to be down there the other day because the guys who are really doing a great business are the kebab makers, the guys in the, you know, who have these carts in the street or small stores where they cook over charcoal fires. They make minced meat kebabs out of mutton, and you know, they're telling me that they're doing fantastic business because a lot of these men don't know how to cook.
We're
talking about a pretty male-dominated society here in which the women do all the cooking, and suddenly there are no women around to cook, so the kebab makers are having a field day.
Now, Kirkuk is still controlled by Saddam Hussein, and you've reported that residents of Kirkuk have been told to leave their doors open for Iraqi soldiers so that the soldiers can take shelter if an aerial assault begins. They must be living in terror.
Well, I think they've been living in terror long before this war. The terror has only increased. We're talking about a regime that has been at odds with the Kurds and has been persecuting the Kurds for decades, and therefore has discriminated against these people in a way that few minorities anywhere in the world have experienced. They've been bombed with chemical weapons. They've been executed, slaughtered, and mass murder. And these people the Kurds who live in Kirkuk have been living under the boot of the people who did this to them. Now, and that is why the issue of Kirkuk is such a poignant one, because it is here where there could be this explosion in ethnic bloodshed if Kirkuk is taken over by American forces, and this is one of the issues that the Bush administration is going to have to deal with. So yes, we've talked, we can actually get through to people sometimes on the phone in Kirkuk. You've got to talk very surreptitiously in code. You can't use names, and they do describe conditions there as being pretty terrifying. They also talk about where some of the bombing has been hitting, but it's something that we do few and far between because of the danger to these people.
Is this your first time covering a war, Jonathan?
No, it's not. I've been covering conflict, particularly ethnic and religious conflict, and not through choice. It's something that I just fell into when I first became a foreign correspondent in 1985. I was sent to India. And I spent 5 years there, and this was at the time of the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, and it was part of my beat to cover Afghanistan. And also at the time there was a Sikh insurrection in the northern Indian state of Punjab, and the insurrection by Muslim fundamentalists in the Indian portion of Kashmir. And then at the same time, there's a civil war going on in Sri Lanka. And all of this was on my beat. And I just, as I said, it just kind of happened that I began covering conflict then. And in 1990, I just happened to be transferred from New Delhi to Belgrade, former Yugoslavia. And I spent 5 years covering the Yugoslav conflict. And so, no, this is not my first conflict.
Now, you're talking to us from the side of the road on your satellite phone, a few miles away from Kirkuk. Yes?
That's about, I guess I'm about 30 miles from Kirkuk where I am now.
Okay. Are you alone in your car?
No, I have my translator and my driver with me.
And have you been traveling with them all over?
With my driver, I've been with him ever since I got here. My translator is relatively new because my first translator laid down the condition that when he first went to work for me, that once the war started, he was going to have to take care of his family, and he really didn't want to get too close to Cham Chamal or that particular area. And we agreed that he would leave me once the war started. So he has done so. We still communicate quite frequently. He does do some fact checking for me back in Sulaymaniyah. We're in contact over cellular telephones, but he's no longer working for me.
You're in something of a waiting period. You're kind of waiting for something to happen in Kirkuk, for a battle to start in Kirkuk. Is this an apprehensive period for you as you wait for that to start, not knowing what will happen and what the outcome will be?
Absolutely. I mean, it's been this, everybody tends to sit around and speculate, well, what's going to go on next? Well, if this happens, then maybe this won't happen. And if they do this, then maybe they won't do that. And the whole question is the biggest question in my mind is, how am I going to cover what I'm supposed to cover? Will I even be able to cover what I'm supposed to cover? You know, my understanding is that down in the South, a lot of journalists have had journalists who've gone unilaterally, like myself, journalists who are not embedded with U.S. forces, have not been able to cross over from Kuwait into southern Iraq. And if they have, it's been a fairly dicey thing. And so the big question in my mind and the mind of all the unilateral journalists who are here, and many of us have been here for months now, is whether or not we're going to even be able to go cover the story that we're here to cover, because there's a chance that we could be stopped by U.S. troops if an offensive is ever launched, or by Kurdish rebels who are now been agreed to put themselves under the command of General Tommy Franks. So that is one of the questions uppermost in our minds, but also the whole question of our safety is always one that we're constantly asking ourselves, constantly assessing. When I go down to Cham Chamal to stay, to Shoreditch to stay, I have guards 24 hours watching the place where I stay. We decided to take stickers off our car today, which said TV on them, only because it kind of makes us stand out, and that's something we don't want to do. And then there's also the threat from Ansar al-Islam. There was a journalist killed about 5 or 6 days ago. It was the question is whether or not he was targeted or not. He was standing on the side of the road. He's an Australian cameraman filming, and there are indications that the car bomber that killed him actually aimed for him. So, there are these concerns also. When things get too dangerous, if they get too dangerous, I'm going to pull back and wait and just assess and see what I'm going to do. So, that's a process that's constantly going on in my mind.
Is there a lot of debate in your mind about your responsibilities as a journalist and your responsibilities to just protect yourself?
Absolutely. One of the things that my bosses are absolutely adamant about is that there's no story that is worth risking your life for. Absolutely none. And I think one of the reasons I was sent by my bosses, that I was selected to do this particular job, is because of the experience I've had doing this kind of thing for almost 15 years now, using the judgment that I've acquired over this time to determine when things are safe enough for me to do my job, and when they're not. And it's a, it, I, you know, this is a, I, the bosses have this confidence in me, and again, that's why I've been sent here, and I guess that's why a lot of the journalists who have been sent to this part of Iraq, that's the confidence their bosses have in them also.
Are you feeling like you did the right thing by choosing to be an independent journalist and to not be embedded?
I'm not sure. I'm sure my wife is very pleased that I didn't get embedded, because I'd be in the middle of some very dangerous fighting right now, and I haven't had to face that at all here. And there's still a question of whether or not I'm going to, you know, that's going to even happen where I am. And if it does, you know, again, it's my I will use my judgment that I've accumulated over all these years to determine where I go and when I go. You know, I'm certainly not going to cross over towards Kirkuk until there's a collapse of the Iraqi troops, if there's a collapse of the Iraqi troops guarding Kirkuk, and that is why I have based myself where I am, down near the front lines, because we will actually be able to see when or if that happens. You know, you have to determine when things are not safe for you to stay where you are. And also, I have to say that we are with people who are Kurds, who know the area, who are from that part of from Kirkuk, who have been back and forth quite regularly through the lines, know where all the positions, the Iraqi positions are, know where there are areas of danger and where there are areas of safety, and these are people whose judgments I also will rely on.
Well, Jonathan, I wish you good luck and safety, and I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us. Thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Jonathan Landay recorded earlier today from northern Iraq. Landay is the national security correspondent for Knight Ridder newspapers.